Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
On May 5th, 1886, thousands of protesters in Milwaukee were nearing the Bayview Rolling Mill when the first shots rang out. The protesters were part of the 8-Hour Movement, seeking better working conditions for laborers in Milwaukee and beyond. State militia had been tasked with guarding the mill. Historian John Gerda explains.
A crowd of roughly 1,200 strikers, largely Polish, gathered at St. Stanislaus Church on 5th and Mitchell, marched down Mitchell Street first and then Kinnikinick to march in the rolling mill. They found the militia waiting for them, and at a distance of roughly 200 yards, the militia opened fire.
As the smoke faded, the devastation became clear. At least 9 people had been shot. The event became known as the Bayview Massacre. But who were the victims, and where were they buried? That's what listener Brenna Ackert wanted to know. She began her own research into the victims, but wrote to Bubbler Talk after reaching some dead ends.
So I was curious if anyone could find any information, because I certainly couldn't. Sometimes we can find names, but that's usually about it. That's like as far as we could go, at least in my own digging.
But let's take a step back and look at what led to the massacre. The 8-Hour Movement was born out of the poor working conditions for factory workers in the mid-1800s. Laborers were expected to work 6 days a week for 10 to 12 hours at a time in grueling conditions.
Their goal was an 8-hour day without a cut in pay. So if you're working 12 hours a day for a buck and a quarter a day on the labor side, that's a big deal. So it was a major request. And Milwaukee and Chicago became the epicenters of that movement in the entire country. And the first week of May 1886 was really among the most volatile in Milwaukee's history.
Starting on May 1st, laborers in Milwaukee and Chicago went on strike. Both cities were filled with strikers, united by a common cause. But on May 4th, these protests turned deadly in Chicago when an unknown man threw dynamite into the crowd, killing at least a dozen people. At the same time, tensions were rising in Milwaukee. Wisconsin's Republican Governor Jeremiah Rusk had ordered the National Guard into Milwaukee to quell the protests. As protesters neared the mill, the orders were given.
The captain of the militia said, pick out your man and kill him. So this was not shooting over their heads to frighten the crowd and have them go back to the south side. This was certainly intentional.
According to news reports from the day, the street looked like a battlefield. People lay dying, bleeding. Since 1986, the centennial anniversary of the massacre, the Wisconsin Labor History Society has held a ceremony honoring the dead with 7 beats to represent the 7 victims believed to have died that day. As question asker Brenna Ackert mentions, there are a number of named victims, but the names change depending on the source you're looking at. What remains consistent is the number, 7. After a quick, targeted search on Ancestry.com, using the most consistent names listed, I was able to find death certificates for 4 of the named victims: Frank Kunkel, Frank Navarchek, Martin Yankoviak, and Michael Rakalski. These death certificates are very helpful because they include other identifying information, including where they were buried. But that was where my good luck ran out. As I started to search for other names, it became clear this would be a difficult task. John Gerda notes that's kind of how this research goes.
Tedious, granular, and I think the lesson from a lot of this research is that history is messy.
To dig into this mess, I used 3 main resources in the Milwaukee Public Library's Zeidler Room: city directories, historic newspapers, and local history books. I started by trying to find these men in the city directories with mixed results. That's when I headed to the historic newspaper database to find contemporary accounts of what happened that day. But these newspapers, while helpful, are only as reliable as the author, as librarian Heather Smith explains.
You have to understand how information is collected and recorded.
She uses the census as an example.
So if a census worker who's a complete stranger to you comes to your door, they're going to write down what you tell them in their record. So if they get some detail wrong because they perceived that you spoke with an accent and they didn't clearly understand what you said to them, that's what gets put into the census records that we now are using for research decades later.
A few things became clear in reading the accounts from that day. The scene was chaotic, and American journalists weren't great at deciphering Polish names. Some victims I had confirmed through death certificates had entirely wrong names listed in the papers. In one article on the day of the massacre from the Milwaukee Daily Journal, Frank Nowarczyk was listed as Jacques Narakak. Martin Jankowiak was instead called Marcus Jokowski. It also included John Marsh among the victims. Now, John Marsh was one of the three remaining names that I was searching for, along with Johann Zaska and Robert Erdman. But as the dust settled the following day, there was an updated list in the Daily Journal with the proper names of everyone who had been shot. John Marsh was now John Maschk. John Maschk had a death certificate that confirmed he'd been killed during the massacre. The misspelling of his name wasn't an anomaly, as librarian Heather Smith notes.
All of this stuff was, in many cases, communicated verbally. If things were written down, they were written down in non-standardized fashion, which is why you'll find variations in spelling in historical records.
In fact, different newspapers would often write names differently. Although he was known as John Maschk in the Daily Journal, he was called Johann Maschke in the Sentinel. Over time, it's likely that John Maschk had been split into two separate victims due to the variance in how his name was spelled. Reading through the newspapers of that time shines light on another reality. Many didn't view these protesters as victims, and that's borne out in their death certificates.
The certificate of Michael Ruchalski, the cause of death is listed as shot in a mob. That's editorial. That's saying this is a guy who was kind of out with the rabble. And it was a fairly accurate reflection, I think, of how people in the mainstream, you know, kind of thought of the disturbances in that first week of May.
That gets to another reality. Most newspapers seemed more concerned about the threat to public order than they were about the fate of those who had been shot. Updates on the injured sunk lower and lower in the newspapers. Most had stopped covering them entirely, less than a week after the massacre. Instead, the newspapers focused on the criminal trials of those who had led the movement.
Any threat to law and order is met with resistance by the establishment. That's why it's called the establishment. You know, both the corporate side and the media side as well. So you have a city shut down by strikers who were marching from one employer to another to dramatize their demands. That was clearly a challenge to the status quo.
The majority of protesters were recent immigrants, and not all of them had ties to the community. These were people who could go missing without much notice, making it very difficult to track them down. The massacre had also pitted neighbor against neighbor. The local Kościuszko guards were among the militiamen who fired on the protesters. They were also Polish immigrants who lived in the same community. While the newspapers lauded the bravery of the militia, many in the Polish community came out against them.
They were boycotted by the people on the south side. And at the same time, people of Polish background in general were kind of stigmatized as Polanders and drunkards need not apply to jobs. So they were kind of the troublesome workers. But also internally, you know, there was division about, you know, the people who were being shot at and the people who were shooting.
It's unclear what happened to the four other victims with serious injuries. But after a lot of research, I can definitively say at least five people died. And I know where they're buried. Holy Trinity Cemetery, now part of St. Adalbert Cemetery in Milwaukee's Morgandale neighborhood. With this information in hand, I went to the cemetery with our question asker, Brenna, and told her what I'd found.
You have really tracked down so much information. I'm so glad I reached out to Bubbler Talk to say, hey, take it away from here. Thank you for looking into this. This has been incredible.
We checked in at the cemetery office and asked them to look up records from the 1880s. There wasn't a single record left from 1886. The exact location of the Bayview Massacre victims' graves seemed to have been lost to time. But the people they represented are still there, and their stories still resonate with our world today.
The larger picture is absolutely incontrovertibly correct, you know, where you have an oppressed workforce resisting oppression and the forces of capital clamping down, closing in. That's the story, and we need to keep sight of that and the impact it had on politics later on families certainly. So whether it's five, whether it's seven, whether it's nine, people died. And they died violent deaths at the hands of their neighbors.
At least 9 people were shot that day in May. Many were severely injured, like Kazimir Dudek, who was shot 4 times in the arm and lost half his jaw. Most victims were laborers whose livelihoods depended on their good health, and those who survived were never the same after that day. But neither was Milwaukee. Although these protests were incredibly controversial, the massacre had helped shift public opinion on labor rights. The sacrifices of the protesters led to better working conditions in the mills and factories, and the rise of a new political party.
It broke the back of the 8-hour movement, but also galvanized those workers to organize politically. So they established a People's Party that swept the next elections, the fall elections. And that was a very important catalyst for the rise of the socialists in Milwaukee.
And maybe learning all of that is worth a bit of digging. For Bubbler Talk, I'm Joy Powers.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Educators Credit Union. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit wuwm.com/bubblertalk to submit your question.
You can find more interviews like this one by visiting wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And while you're there, subscribe to the Lake Effect Spotlight podcast.